Hello, my name is Dario Balca, student coordinator for the Peter A. Allard School of Law History Project. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge that UBC's Vancouver Point Grey campus is situated on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. For those listening to this recording outside this area, I would also like to acknowledge the traditional owners and caretakers of those lands. It's July 23rd, 2020, and I have the privilege today of speaking to Ryan Black. Ryan practices technology-related business law as a partner at DLA Piper, focusing on intellectual property, information technology, and video games. He's also involved with the Allard School of Law as a member of the Dean's Advisory Committee for the Center for Business Law and as a clinic adjunct with the Business Law Clinic. Ryan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
I wanted to start by asking you a little bit about your life before law school, and I was wondering if you can tell me a little bit about what led you to a career in the field.
I probably had a maybe similar to some, but not similar to many people, approach the law in the sense that I never set out to be a lawyer, and I certainly never set out to be a partner at a law firm and to be have done it for as long as I have. I went to law school primarily because when I graduated with my business degree, I didn't want to go get another job. I felt like I wasn't quite done with school yet, and I loved my business law classes. And as a result, I applied to law school. I went to the U of A for my law school and really loved. I was one of those students that I hear about all the time at UBC and other schools that, every class you go to is your favorite class, and you're, I don't know what I want to do. I learned this today and maybe I want to do that, and then I learned something else the next day and I want to do that instead. And I loved every aspect of it, but was always kind of drawn to the business side of law, and so was thrilled to come out to Vancouver and practice in that area. I didn't really have any grand plan on what I was going to do once I became a lawyer. Everyone else was articling, everyone else was applying to law firms. I thought, yeah, I should do that too. And I've loved every step of the way.
Speaking of that, it's always interesting to hear about how people transition from school into whatever area they end up practicing in. I know you clerked, but can you tell me a bit more in detail how you went from school to where you are now?
So I clerked, actually was super hot out of law school. I was pretty sure I was going to do tax law. I was 100% sure I was going to do tax law, actually. And I clerked at the Tax Court of Canada and loved it. And even when I went to article for my firm, which at the time was called Lang Mitchner, I intended to do tax law. And the clerking taught me how to deal with clerking at the tax court is different than a lot of clerkships in that it was a lot like a law firm. There was, at the time, 27 judges and 7 clerks, and you kind of just got whatever files people had, and you had to work with the clerks to figure out who was going to work on what, and you didn't kind of have any permanent assignments or anything like that. So it was very much like managing partners at a law firm when you're an associate trying to figure out, everyone gives you an urgent task. Okay, whose urgent task am I going to do first? So I really enjoyed that aspect of it, and I also really enjoyed the intellectual pursuit because at the court level, tax law is very much, debating about what the meaning of a phrase is or debating what the fair interpretation of something is and all these things. And when I actually went to practice, when I went to article for the tax group at Lang Mitchner, I very quickly learned that the commercial side of tax law isn't really much like that. It's very much like interpreting specific portions of the act and determining what risks there are, and then figuring out how you can slot your clients into those risks appropriately. And it was just such a different endeavor than what I thought it was going to be, that like so many students, what I thought I was going to do coming out of law school ended up not being what I did at all. And so when I realized that tax law wasn't for me, it was actually during my articles, I had that kind of moment where I had to go to my article principals and say, so, hey, just so you know, I'm not really that into tax anymore. That wasn't that fun, but they were great. And they said, well, what do you want to do? And I had thought about that in advance if they asked me that question, what I was going to say. And I decided it was really important to pick something that I genuinely cared about in my off time, something that it genuinely kind of drove my passions to begin with. And so that's how I landed in the technology sector, because I'm a total tech nerd in my, off time. I would be reading about copyright and patent issues, in my spare time if people didn't pay me to do it. And I thought, it'd be really neat to work in an area where I could actually leverage that. And at the time, I never imagined I could work in other areas of passion that I work with, like video games and sports groups and esports and things like that. I mean, at the time, first of all, esports wasn't really a thing, but secondly, the thought of like a big firm lawyer working for video game companies just seemed very unrealistic to me. But, you know, what I found over time is you can kind of make your career what you want it to be. And I've really been blessed to have had a lot of time to, and a lot of support from the lawyers I've worked with over the years to basically pursue the areas that I wanted to pursue.
Yeah. And somewhat relatedly to that, I know that you spent a lot of time at McMillan before moving to DLA Piper early this year. You were talking about a big firm lawyer working for video game companies being this kind of new thing. So I wanted to ask you, starting out and while you were at McMillan, how do you build up your network and how do you find clients? Like, what's your approach when you're in that kind of world?
I think authenticity is actually the biggest approach that I've found works. There's two things that I'm not the sort of lawyer that walks into a room, meets a bunch of people, shakes a bunch of hands and walks out with 10 clients. It's never worked that way for me in my entire life. But what I tend to do is do a good job for clients. And then those clients either come back to me for other work or when they have friends or they move on to another career and they decide that they're going to work in it, they get me that. And so I kind of just leveraged those same skills when I decided that I wanted to pivot more into the video game space. So I started out generally just doing anything technology related. And then when I decided I wanted to pivot in the video game space, I kind of just used those same skills. So I would go to a lot of conferences. I would try to speak on issues. I would try to read about issues and really become subject matter proficient so that if a client anywhere in the firm had any question that even touched on video games or esports or anything like that, I would make sure that people at the firm knew that I was the person to talk to. And then, you know, you do a good job on that file. And next thing you know, someone else brings in an esports file and the very first person they think of is Ryan Black. And then that person has a contact that's starting a business in Germany somewhere. And so I've been at a conference where I've met some German lawyers and I say, hey, I've got this video game client that wants to do something in Germany. Can you connect me? And then 2 years later, those Germans refer me a file right back. And so you just kind of start the network that way. And so I found that doing a good job and being proficient, understanding the business and caring about the business goes a long way. And particularly with tech clients. One thing that I cannot stress enough with tech clients is they're surrounded by people who are in tech for the money, or who are, you know, looking to raise make a bunch of cash, or VCs that want to, you know, get a big multiple on the exit or whatever. But at their heart, tech people are like the most, everybody who starts a tech product thinks they're solving the planet's worries with their technology thing. Very few of them go into it with, oh, hey, we want to make a bunch of money. They go into it saying, wouldn't it be awesome if we disrupted this industry and just changed every way the way that everybody hails cabs and, you know, out comes Uber? Or wouldn't it be awesome if we just made it so that hotels didn't have monopoly on staying with all these empty properties and out comes Airbnb? Like, that's how these things start. And so the authenticity of caring about what it is they're doing really speaks to tech entrepreneurs because they're surrounded by people who really know the business side of things or really are, you know, proficient with money. And that's all table stakes. But I think what differentiates people in the space is people who really are passionate about technology. So when I go to a video game lawyers conference or a tech conference, and I see clients that are doing things that I care about, I talk to them about their products. I talk to them about the things they're working on and the cool things I've seen. And I found it works very well. You know, when I go to a video game conference or a video game lawyers conference, and they're very different things. At one, you dress up as Mario, and at the other, it's not a great idea to dress up as Mario. But when I go to them, you know, I go to the ones that I've played your game. I've bought your game. I've recommended it to friends, or I can't get past this level or whatever it is. And I have those conversations and they know that I'm authentic.
You mentioned having a passion for video games and sort of tech related things generally. I know that you also have some professional experiences in software development. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering to what extent that informed the route you ended up taking and how maybe the insights and experience you gained in that field inform the way that you can help your clients now.
Well, first of all, you know, I don't think it's a prerequisite to be, you know, a software developer or a science background or anything to be a good tech lawyer. I think it's just helpful in the sense that I can speak the same language as a lot of my software clients. So when they're, you know, complaining to me about a developer who used a poorly dynamically linked library or something, I know what they mean by that. But at the end of the day, I don't know that that affects my legal work. What I have found, though, is that the logical process that you use to code software, not to get too nerdy here, but software at the end of the day is an iterative process where you start with inputs and you're trying to end up with an output. And that may sound very familiar because that's exactly what a contract is, or when you're trying to do a business deal, you're starting with inputs and you're trying to end up somewhere. And the process that you go through in computer programming, trying to figure out where the recursions are and where the loops are and where the potential errors are, you know, the errors in the input or the errors in the assumptions that might not, that might result in the output that you don't want to see. That's the same logical process that you do when you're drafting a contract to say, you know, hey, these people want to get together and do X, Y, and Z, and they want the result to be A, B, and C. What could go wrong in the meantime? You know, what, how would we get there, and what would be the efficient way to do that and to set up the rules for that? I find it's a very similar process. And so, you know, apart from these kind of knowledge of the industry that I've gained from it, I've actually found that my programming brain gets triggered a lot and gets used a lot by helping clients with their contracts and doing drafting exercises and things like that. I find like I'm coding just in legal language now. It's quite familiar to me.
A super interesting way of looking at it. Yeah. From someone who knows nothing about software development.
Yeah, well, no, trust me, the few people who are listening to this who are software people is like, yeah, I get what he's saying.
But. Technology law in and of itself isn't a new thing, but as you've mentioned, it's changed a lot, and it's changed a lot in particular areas. And I imagine it's something that continues to change pretty rapidly. Yeah. Can you elaborate a little bit on that and what kind of areas you have to keep up to date with it that we see the most change in?
Sure. I mean, fundamentally, it's like acting for a client base of the most active and ever-evolving people that you can imagine. So like, you know, the forestry industry has kind of been the way it is for like 60 or 70 years or whatever it is. And things move slowly there. And there are sometimes big jumps and steps that move you to another level. So like, let's say that, you know, environmental social governance becomes an issue. And so all of a sudden these resource companies are now moving, they're now considering something extra. There's a big movement that causes kind of like a colossal change. But the tech industry is all about these like super iterative month over month, year over year changes and staying on top of all those little, because the fundamentally tech industries are just trying to do processes more efficiently. Like they're trying to pull every bit of efficiency right out of every process they're working on. So like, how do we cut this middleman, or how do we make this more efficient, or how do we do this automatically, or whatever it is. And so you end up with like, even in their own business practices, they're changing month over month or year over year, and they're making huge pivots. And so like one day you'll be working with someone who's like a software developer that's, you know, selling traditional software by handing CDs to customers. And then like the next month they come to you saying, nope, we're entirely cloud-based now and everything's delivered over the internet. And so you kind of have to stay on top of all these kind of incremental changes on top of all the big changes that happen from time to time. So it has certainly been a 15-year learning experience since I started practicing in 2005. I'm constantly learning new things. You know, the things that made me a software developer and a web developer when I was in my pre-law career are now like, I'd be a dinosaur. I'd be the most useless computer programmer on the planet. Like things have moved that far, that fast. So, you know, I have to, you know, just kind of stay on top of the way that things move and not get too bogged down by the details. You know, one of my favorite examples is something that entirely has arisen in the course. It wasn't a thing of, you know, before my career started, was blockchain. And everyone assumed that I'd be like Mr. Blockchain because I was the tech guy. But frankly, the technology / tech legal side of blockchain is not interesting. It's all open source software. It's freely available. Every company and their grandmother can invent a new Bitcoin and like alternative tomorrow because it's all open source software. It's all freely licensed. Where the real work ended up being there was on the securities and the money laundering side and the regulated market side. And so while I was getting a lot of, and I had to be familiar with blockchain because I had a block, you know, in 2017 and 18 and 19, I probably had a blockchain conversation every day, but I wasn't doing any legal work about it. So I would get that, I would talk to people about their blockchain work, and then I would find someone at my firm that could actually work on it because it wasn't anything that I actually worked on.
Yeah. Seems like it'd be challenging to keep up with all these changes in a certain way. But also I imagine there's an excitement to being involved in an area that's so dynamic as well, right?
Yeah. And that is the, you know, yeah, it's certainly challenging. And one of the main challenges of practicing in the area, particularly in Canada, is that we have like, first of all, a very fast moving industry in the technology sector. It's very fast. We have very slow legislators. So, you know, we had a new Copyright Act that they were talking about for years and years and years, and it passed in 2012, and then no one's touched it since. And like, the Copyright Act that was passed in 2012 was pretty technologically advanced, but just think about where we were in 2012. I mean, the iPhone was like version 2 or 3 at that point or something. Like all these, you know, Google Play services and Apple Arcade has launched since then, and Netflix is now a fully online service. It was probably still DVD by then. You know, like things have really changed in the copyright sphere since we came with others. So the legislation moves really slow. The industry moves really fast, and then Canadians just generally aren't that litigious. So the biggest challenge is when a client comes to me with an issue, I can't point them to a case that gives them their answer. I have to like extract what the answer would probably be if it were ever to go to court, because there's like one or two published decisions that are even in the same area of law, let alone about their specific legal problem. If you go across the border to the United States, you know, a case has been litigated on virtually every issue in the tech community. And in Canada, it's like, well, the Americans have done this, and there was like one case in Spain that did this, but you know, generally we just don't have a lot of cases.
I know you've been involved with a few professional organizations, including the Canadian IT Law Organization and the Video Game Bar Association. Can you tell me a bit about your involvement with those groups and why you think it's important for people who practice in your areas to have access to these organizations and to these communities?
Yeah, I think it's really critical to be whatever community you're dialed into, to be dialed into a community that you're actually engaged with. And the reason that I pick things like the Canadian IT Law Organization or the Video Game Bar Association, and you know, for example, I'm also a director of the Canadian Internet Registry Authority. I pick those things because I actually care about them, and I'm actually going to show up and do the work, and meet people, and set up, you know, extracurricular lunches and dinners and stuff, and talk to the people and get to know them a little bit and know their issues. In the tech world in particular, there's like so many organizations and meetups and groups and startup communities and incubators, and you could every day, well, maybe in the great before the pandemic, I suppose you could go to an event every day if you wanted to. Now it's all online stuff, but you know, there's no shortage of groups and organizations that you can get involved with. And it's almost overwhelming, particularly when you're a junior lawyer, just how many different business development and professional development opportunities there are. And so I've learned over time, instead of trying to go to all of them, which is what I originally tried to do, is to focus on the ones that I really care about, where I'm really going to be engaged and have meaningful long-term connections with people. Because the process of developing your practice, whether it's learning new skills or developing business, is a very long-term process. And if I could go back to 2005, Ryan, and tell him anything, it's like, don't sweat that all this work you're doing isn't paying off, you know, in the year that you're doing it, or even the year after you do it, because 5 years from now, you're not going to have enough time to even worry about, you know, what types of BD things you're going to do this year. It's a really long-term game. The practice of law is like that's why it's a career, right? It's a long-term game. It's not done in, you know, you don't go to a conference and generate a bunch of work and then go home and forget about it. It's like, no, you're doing it for years and years and you're grinding at it.
Yeah. I wanted to talk now a little bit about your involvement with the Allard School of Law. I know you're part of the Dean's Advisory Committee for the Center for Business Law, and you've been involved with the center for several years. Can you tell me a bit about how that came about?
Yeah, sure. So I was the kind of co-chair of our business law startups practice when I was at Macmillan. And Macmillan is, of course, a supporter, a strong supporter of the business law, Center for Business Law at Allard. And so, you know, when the kind of call went out to form the committee, first of all, it was a great idea. It's been just a wonderful networking opportunity to actually talk to other lawyers at firms. So the interesting thing about being a business lawyer, particularly in the tech sector in Vancouver, is I very rarely work on files where on the other side of a file is another BC business lawyer or even another Vancouver business lawyer, because you know, my clients are doing deals in California and Australia and UK, and the internet basically allows them to do work all over the world. So when I'm on a phone with another lawyer on a deal, I'm often on the phone with a lawyer in another country or another city. So for me personally, the idea of being able to contribute to the Faculty of Law and particularly to the Center for Business Law at Allard was really critical, because it's not very often that these opportunities come up at UBC where they typically focus on, you know, social justice issues or environmental issues or environmental social governance or things like that, which are all very important. But, you know, as a pure business lawyer that does, you know, commercial transaction and people, you know, make or lose lots of money or stuff like that, it's hard to sometimes feel like I can actually contribute back to the law community where they're so focused on, you know, indigenous issues or family law issues or criminal law issues and all sorts of things. So a business law opportunity was awesome. And we do some really cool stuff, like the Center for Business Law is led by Dr. Lau, and it just does incredible work. And I'm so proud of my involvement with that group. I think in 2019, they had something like 26 events throughout the city where, you know, it was like someone would be talking about, you know, environmental social governance in mining one week, and then the next week it would be like an equity panel on improving diversity at law firms, and then there'd be another week where it would be a meetup for law firms to meet and greet the students. So contributing to the organization of all that through the Dean's Advisory Committee has just been amazing. It's been very rewarding. And so, you know, even with my move over to DLA, I've been able to continue to contribute to that committee. Now, not because I'm at Macmillan, because I'm not at Macmillan anymore, but actually now because I'm one of the professors of the clinics at the Center for Business Law.
Yeah, and like you were saying, the people who are part of this clinic are, you know, dedicated to this particular area. And the students have, you know, they want to go down that road in terms of their careers. As a clinic adjunct, what are some of your goals when you're talking to students or teaching or anything like that?
I mean, the biggest thing is that I'm trying to tease out from them, is this something you really want to do? And not in a negative way, but in a positive way. Being a lawyer involves often dealing with your clients when they're having super hard problems. You know, they can't figure it out, so they've decided they need to hire a lawyer. I mean, just imagine the mindset that gets you to, I mean, it's so normal for us because we're a law firm. Of course, people hire us. But having been, you know, in my own personal life in situations where I've had to hire a lawyer before, it's rarely a time where it's low stress that you're like, hey, I really need to hire a lawyer. In fact, it's times where there's either great opportunity or great risk. And so the type of emotional and kind of you find yourself being, particularly with startups and technology companies, you find yourself being a little bit the person that's putting the fly in the soup, because they have all these wonderful ideas and you're sitting there trying to think of all the things that could go wrong with those ideas. And that's your job as a lawyer. And so, you know, at a very high level, what I really hope that people come away from the clinic, when they're students at the clinic, I hope they come away with the idea that in business law, it's not about advising your clients everything that could go wrong. It's about advising your clients where the risks are and letting them make their decisions. You know, you don't stop your client from doing something just because it's risky. You give them advice so that they understand those risks and they can decide whether or not they want to take that risk. The very types of people who quit a job to start their own business or who plunk millions of bucks down to invest in a new technology, they're not risk-averse people. If they understand their risks and they quantify it, they can get over it. And so through the work in the clinic, you know, we're often faced with things where at the very beginning in the clinic, I get the sense that the students are like, wow, some of these files, they're asking for things that I'm not sure that we're going to be able to do. And it's because they're trying to solve the problem. They're not trying to step back and say, how do I advise the client on the risks so that they can determine whether they want to solve the problem or not, number one. And then number two, what are the ways that we can do solve this problem that maybe just make it less of a risk and make it palatable to them? And so it really is about risk. You know, in law school, I feel like there's a lot of you should or shouldn't do this. Like a lot of the classes are, this is allowed and this is not allowed, or this is legal or this is not legal. The business world just generally doesn't work like this. There's very rarely a law that says you're not allowed to charge customer A $50 for something and customer B $25 for something. It's like, what are the risks if customer B finds out he paid double for what customer A did, right? Like that's really what the law speaks to. It doesn't speak to the specific situation. So it's always about teasing out those risks and making sure people understand where they are on that continuum. And I think it's a really critical thing for law students to understand before they go practice business law.
Yeah. And in a narrower sense, if a student comes to you and says, I'm interested in business law, IP as relates to technology, video games, something like that, mm-hmm. What should I focus on during school? How do I make my way into that industry? What advice would you give that person?
First of all, I would say law school is a great place to learn things that you aren't going to have time to learn when you're a practicing lawyer. So I'm a big believer, and I know this is going to sound very counterintuitive for someone who's a tech lawyer, but I'm a very big believer in taking like the hard black letter law courses in law school, because trust me when I tell you that when you're like a sixth year lawyer, you're not going to have time to learn how trusts work or estates or family law stuff or whatever it is, like that hard stuff that, you know, people kind of roll their eyes and say, oh, I'd rather be taking, you know, the fun video game law class or whatever. I get it. But on the other hand, the best time to learn that stuff is in law school. First of all, at Allard, I've always found, and you know, I've guest lectured a lot of their classes, whether it's competition law or corporate law. Professors of a topic of law, they're like super nerdy and enthused about their little area of law. And so while estates or trusts or evidence may sound boring to you, trust me, it doesn't have to be boring because those people love it. That's why they're teaching it. And that's the best way to learn it, because when you're a practicing lawyer and one of your clients comes to you and says, hey, we've got all these trust issues, and you say, okay, I have to figure out this trust stuff, you have one of two options. You can go to your library and crack open a book on trusts and try to read about it and fall asleep in the first 5 minutes. Or you can refer your work out to someone else. And so trust me, you don't do the book reading one. You would end up finding someone else who can help you. So getting a groundwork flavor for all of these different areas just allows you, even if you end up, I'm not going to be a trust lawyer, I'm not going to be a family law lawyer, I'm not going to work in estates. But if you understand the basic issues there, when a client comes to you that they're talking about how their company is owned by a trust, or the company was owned by a father who's now deceased and so it's owned by the estate, you're not going to be mystified like I was when a client came and told me that, right? Like, so it's all valuable. And so that's the other thing I think I would sell is, you know, sell to students about their law school experience, is that I've very rarely found that anything I've done in law that isn't directly related to the practice that I want to do is a waste of time. Before I developed my technology law practice, and certainly before I developed my video game law practice, when I was at Macmillan and they were primarily known as a securities firm working with resource companies, you know, I would work on mining option agreements or forest timber option agreements or, you know, a license of land or whatever it is, because that was the work that was available to me. But all those skills that I learned are directly relevant to the types of contracts that I do for my clients all the time. So a license agreement for a timber property is not that different than a license agreement for some technology inside of your product. There are different considerations, but fundamentally, if you learn about how licenses work and the different options available and stuff like that, it's actually helpful. And it's the same for estates and trusts and tax and business law and anything you want. I think you should focus in law school on learning as much as you can and doing as well as you can. And if you think that you're going to be fired up by an evidence class, don't think that your future career in video games is going to be stunted by that. If you're fired up by a class and you do well and you learn stuff, you're going to be able to apply that to your future practice no matter what it is.
You've spoken about how kind of dynamic this area of practice is, because that's how the technology industry is, at least right now. Mm-hmm. So this question might not withstand the test of time, but I wonder right now, July 23rd, 2020, what tech trends those of us who are interested should be keeping an eye on?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, there's a waning and ebbs and flows about this whole idea of a standard kind of way of doing business. So we see these platforms arise from time to time. You know, Amazon is now just a behemoth in the e-commerce industry. If you think about it, Amazon started in books and then they kind of flowed out from there. But what they're really trying to now do is basically capture all the ways that human beings buy and sell things. And if you were to take a look at their platform and technology play, what they've done is they've abstracted their core business, which is retailing, and said, what are we actually offering here? We're actually offering an online platform. And for that reason, their cloud services and their fulfilled by Amazon direct merchant services are actually bigger money makers, I think. I could be wrong about this, but they're at least decent money makers than the actual retailing side of the business. And so I think the biggest thing to keep an eye on is what, when a technology is introduced, you know, I find, for example, Uber's technology to be very interesting, the idea of connecting people with their phones in real time with the maps, but fundamentally they're basically making ride hailing a little bit easier than hailing down a taxi. You know where your taxi is. A lot of the information is nice to have, but not necessary. But when I look at the type of platform that like an Uber or an Airbnb has built or something, it's like, wow, can you imagine a world where you can connect with someone directly without anyone else involved. And the technology just matches you with the person who can offer it is the thing that you need. And so I'm always trying to think about the way that technologies are being abstracted on a daily basis. And in my industry, one of the biggest areas where we see this is in is with Fortnite. So Epic Games, Fortnite, every parent in the world is probably cursing me for even saying the word because all their kids are spending all their money on it and playing it. But Fortnite is at its heart, you know, a video game where people log on for free and play with each other. But what it's becoming is an actual community. So they're doing concert launches there now. They did the Star Wars Rise of the Skywalker reveal trailer inside of Fortnite. So the entire game world paused for a second while some starships flew overhead and the trailer played. And those sorts of things, I mean, that's looking at a video game and saying, what is it we're actually offering here? We're actually offering a platform where people connect with each other. And so the ways, I don't know what it's going to be, but every tech company is kind of going to go through a phase where they're like, whoa, this is the thing that we're doing, but what are we actually doing here? Like, what at our heart are we actually doing? Another example I like to use, it's a Vancouver example because they have one of their big dev offices here, is the technology company Slack. So Slack actually started off, believe it or not, as a video game. It was a multiplayer, massively multiplayer online game. And the game wasn't going that, like, I don't think the people that were developing that game thought that the game was developing very well, but they developed this really cool communications tool inside the game. And out of that came Slack. And so, like, you never know where these things are going to come from, and I couldn't possibly predict what the next one is going to be. But this idea that so many technology companies are sitting in on an idea that's really revolutionary underneath the actual product offering. That's the one where, like, if you see a client that's doing something really, really cool and it's working in one industry, the first thing you should be thinking about is, if we abstract this out, how many industries could this dominate in? And you usually find that there's something there.
Interesting. Yeah. Brian, are there any exciting roles or projects that you're taking on in your future that you'd like to share?
No, I mean, for right now, my biggest focus has been the shift from Macmillan to DLA, which has been quite a jump. And as you might imagine, you know, I joined here in January and the pandemic hit in March. So it's been quite an experience to start a new practice at a new place. For me, you know, I'm my 3 years as a board member at the Canadian Internet Registration Authority has expired, and I'm now reapplying for another 3-year term. It's quite a commitment, but it's really awesome to be a part of a community that basically, I mean, that the whole point of that organization is to make .ca available to Canadians and to really build a better online Canada. And so it's a lot of fun to work on that. Other than that, no, I mean, I hope to continue to build a great team, both at Allard, where I now have a co-adjunct professor in Tyson Grattan, and then here at DLA as well, where I have just an amazing team of lawyers that I work with. I mean, my biggest projects that I'm working on right now is just kind of making that transition into being a senior lawyer, where I can't work on every file because my clients can't pay me to work on every file, and instead working on becoming a leader, both at the firm at Allard, and then also, you know, an ally in the diversity and inclusion field. I think these are all things that I'm really focusing on in the next 2 to 3 years.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, of course. No, happy to do that.